Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kostas Panayiotokas, author and associate professor of sociology, who assesses the growing public resistance to austerity measures in Greece and the overall Eurozone crisis. Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who discusses the campaign now being organized to overturn provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows the government to indefinitely detain American citizens. And Patty Lovera of Food and Water Watch, who talks about her group's petition calling for further study of genetically engineered salmon out of concern that this new transgenic fish could present a hazard to human health. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As World Bank President Robert Zoellick, a Republican appointed to the job by President George W. Bush, is scheduled to leave his post in June, the scramble is on to name a new president of the controversial global lending institution, whose mission is to reduce global poverty. Since 1944, when the World Bank was created at the Bretton Woods Conference, Washington has nominated the president of the Development Bank, while Europeans have run its sister organization, the International Monetary Fund. But now, several groups, including Oxfam, the African Forum, and Network on Debt and Development, want the United States to abandon its monopoly of the World Bank presidency. Some commentators concerned about the issue are promoting a list of heads of state from the developing world, including Michelle Bachelet of Chile, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil, and Luisa Diogo of Mozambique. Over 60 civil society groups recently sent a letter to the World Bank board asserting that the new president should have the support of a majority of World Bank member nations who are borrowers from low and moderate income countries. Yet election year politics in the U.S. may derail the aspirations of emerging nations hoping to lead the World Bank for the first time. Key Democratic and Republican congressional leaders say they want to keep the World Bank's top job in American hands. In upstate New York, hope for an economic rebound centers on a high-tech chipmaker, Global Foundries, which has made a $4 billion investment in a new state-of-the-art factory, creating over 1,000 new jobs. These are highly skilled jobs in the tech sector, where the educated American workforce has an advantage over low-wage manufacturing hubs in China and Vietnam. The project was launched thanks to a $1.2 billion investment by New York State in the form of tax credits and training programs set up at local community colleges. In 2011, 330 manufacturing-related jobs were created in the U.S., but while that's positive news, it doesn't make up for the 2.3 million manufacturing jobs lost during the recession that officially ended nearly 3 years ago. Although most of the 6 million such jobs lost during the last decade will likely never return, industry analysts are hoping that maybe a million new manufacturing jobs could come back in coming years. White House economic advisor Gene Sperling is upbeat about the state of U.S. manufacturing. In early January, carmakers Chrysler and BMW announced plans to hire 2,500 workers in U.S. auto and truck plants. Across the United States, signatures are being gathered for a new middle-of-the-road political party named Americans Elect that is being bankrolled by wealthy Wall Street and private equity investors to challenge the presidential candidates of the Democratic and Republican parties. So far, Americans Elect has raised over $22 million, almost exclusively from wealthy donors and friends of Americans Elect founder Peter Ackerman, a financier who made his name on Wall Street in the 1980s, working with junk bond king Michael Milken. In June, Americans Elect's 350,000 online members will nominate a candidate for president. The only requirement is the nominee chosen must pick a running mate from the opposite party. Americans Elect says it is organizing to become a moderate alternative to the major political parties, offering pragmatic solutions to the nation's many problems. While the group blames Democrats and Republicans for gridlock in Washington and lack of progress on key issues like immigration and the budget deficit, they fail to point out the role of extremist Tea Party views within the GOP and remain silent on the crisis of growing economic inequality. Campaign finance reformers complain that Americans Elect is deliberately hiding the names of its financial contributors by filing with the federal government as a 501c4 nonprofit organization, the same tax status as many super PACs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
European finance ministers agreed on February 21st to a second bailout of the Greek economy, avoiding for now the threat of default, which many observers fear could trigger a crisis that would endanger the survival of the eurozone. The so-called Troika, made up of the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and the International Monetary Fund, negotiated a deal that will cut the principal on Greek bonds and lower the interest rate paid. In exchange for the $172 billion loan, European officials demanded the Greek government approve harsh austerity measures to reduce the nation's debt-to-GDP ratio to 120% by the year 2020. Although tens of thousands of Greeks marched and rallied in militant protests opposing the austerity measures across the country, the Greek parliament approved a package that included 150,000 layoffs from government jobs by 2015 and steep cutbacks in the minimum wage, healthcare budget, and pensions. Another controversial provision of the debt deal forced Greece to amend its constitution, giving priority to debt servicing payments before any other national obligations are met. With an unemployment rate of 21%, many economists warn that the austerity policies will only worsen economic conditions in Greece, with no hope to reverse the decline. Your reporter spoke with Kostas Panayiotakis, associate professor of sociology at the New York City College of Technology and author of the book Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. He assesses growing public resistance to austerity measures in Greece and the overall eurozone crisis.
There is a massive assault on working people and ordinary citizens in Greece right now. And we see people's living conditions and incomes have collapsed, and unemployment is skyrocketing. We're talking about 21% of the population, 50% of young people. As a result, there is a growing resistance. People see that these policies are not leading anywhere, and they are no longer willing to give the government the benefit of the doubt. The government tries to terrify people into submissions, telling them that without these austerity policies, there will be chaos. But increasingly, people see that this chaos is all around them precisely because of these policies.
The austerity measures that were just recently adopted by the Greek parliament have caused a lot of people to be very concerned for their nation's future. There was a 22% cut, I believe, in the minimum wage threshold, 150,000 layoffs in coming years. And maybe you could discuss a bit about the kind of pain that this is causing the average Greek citizen.
Yes, every segment of the Greek society has been affected by these measures. The reduction of the minimum wage is accompanied by a destruction of labor rights and collective bargaining that is likely to reduce the wages of all private sector workers. There have been successive pay cuts for public sector workers and for pensions. And as a result, there is a growing sense of desperation, rising poverty rates, homelessness, hunger. And these phenomena are increasingly affecting even people who were till recently solidly middle class. So we're talking increasingly about a humanitarian crisis. I was listening to a report by the Doctors of the World who are active in Athens, and they were calling for people to donate food. And they were saying that what they see in Greece right now is the kind of thing that one would normally expect from really low-income countries in Africa.
What are the alternatives? What can the Greek people do as opposed to just accept these austerity measures? There is resistance in the streets, as has been widely reported, but to what end? There are elections that are expected as early as April. Are there alternative political ways to handle this crisis that have emerged during these months of people looking for alternative solutions?
Well, I think the most important thing is for people to say no to these policies, in the sense that it doesn't make sense for Greece to keep borrowing more and more money to service a debt that is already unsustainable. And there are other sort of platforms and proposals by political parties, especially on the left in Greece, and also by economists. And there is no sort of one platform, one alternative platform that has universal sort of assent among the critics of austerity. But there is a debate about whether Greece should exit the euro and devalue its currency, or whether it should just basically declare default within the eurozone and put pressure on Europe to change this austerity strategy that is leading nowhere and that is deepening the crisis even within Europe and the eurozone. But the problem, of course, is that as the opposition to austerity increases, there is growing pressure from European political and economic elites not to allow Greeks to basically have a say over the decisions that will seal their fate for the coming decades. So now Greece has an unelected prime minister who's a former banker. He basically pushes these measures through a parliament that no longer reflects the wishes of Greek citizens. His government is supported by what used to be the two major parties in Greece, the Socialists and the Conservatives. But the support, according to all the polls, for these parties has collapsed. So you have basically a parliament that does not reflect the current opinion of Greek citizens. And this parliament is pushing a loan package and the measures that will basically commit Greek governments in the future to policies that Greek citizens have not had a chance to have a say on.
That was Kostas Panayotakis, associate professor of sociology at the New York City College of Technology and author of the book Remaking Scarcity. Find links to more views on the Greek and European economic crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, on New Year's Eve last year at a time that was sure to elicit little media coverage. The president had earlier promised to veto the bill if provisions were not removed that called for the indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens and non-citizens arrested on American soil on suspicion of engaging in terrorism without charge or trial. Although these provisions were not removed, Mr. Obama ignored his pledge and signed the bill into law, along with a signing statement declaring that he had serious reservations about the indefinite imprisonment provisions and would not engage in such imprisonment of American citizens. But the statement only applies to how Mr. Obama would deal with the law and is not binding on his successors in the White House. As opposition to the indefinite detention provisions grow, a coalition of peace and civil rights groups held a meeting on February 18th at a Hartford, Connecticut mosque. The meeting, attended by about 100 people of many backgrounds, was organized to plan a response to the NDAA provisions, which they assert threatens the civil liberties of all Americans. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who spoke at the meeting. Here he outlines what the legislation will allow and the efforts underway to educate Americans about what he says are its most dangerous provisions.
The NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, includes two provisions, two sections, sections 1021 and 1022, that relate to indefinite military detention. They are intentionally ambiguous, and if you read the law without having a great deal of context, it might seem that they allow for due process to continue for some people. Even under the most charitable readings of the bill, the NDAA abrogates the right to trial and due process for non-citizens and for citizens apprehended outside the United States. The fact of the matter is that even for U.S. citizens within the United States, the NDAA does, in fact, authorize detention without trial, particularly because the existing authorities particularly the authorization to use military force in Afghanistan, the AUMF, has already been used to assert that power. What the NDAA does is codify what used to be a unilateral executive assertion applied to two Americans over the last 10 years and then creates a statutory framework when it can now be applied to anyone. You might think of the NDAA in very short terms as the bill that extends Guantanamo Bay beyond Guantanamo Bay into the domestic United States and across our country from coast to coast, giving any future president the authority essentially to round up political opposition without allowing people a day in court to prove their innocence.
Obama was making noises that he would, at first he said he would veto this bill, and then all of a sudden he felt like some changes were made that he said, now I'm comfortable with it and I'll support it. And he signed a signing statement saying that it wouldn't apply to U.S. citizens within the country. So does that give you any sense of security?
None at all. The president has a unfortunately long habit of breaking promises with respect to civil rights and civil liberties. And when he was running for the White House, he promised to filibuster the FISA law that authorized the NSA's warrantless wiretapping scheme before ultimately voting for it. He promised to veto the NDAA before ultimately voting for it. And in the signing statement, his latest promise says that, well, as long as I'm in the White House, we won't do this to U.S. citizens. The problem is that, A, he doesn't stick to his promises, so even while he's in the White House, that doesn't hold a great deal of water. Second, the signing statement by this administration in no way constrains future administrations.
I've been kind of shocked by the lack of media outrage that would then, you know, presumably extend to the population that might want to do something about this. Have there been any campaigns via social media that have taken this up? And if so, have they garnered much support? Do you know?
So we're certainly running one at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And I would say that, you know, our traffic has increased maybe threefold since the NDAA emerged. That's a scratch of the surface. It's not even a drop in the bucket. I mean, it has to be much bigger than that. One observation that I'd offer, just to sort of carry your point forward, on December 15th, Bill of Rights Day, there were 30 different cities in which grassroots actions along the lines of marches, rallies, took place opposing the NDAA. None of them, not a single one, nor all 30 together, got any press coverage. It is the equivalent, as far as I can see, the closest thing I've seen to a coordinated media blackout of any subject matter I've ever seen. And I think part of the reason is that neither the press nor even the members of Congress who voted for this law quite understand what it means. And that obfuscation, the ambiguity, makes it, I think, it's a disincentive for media to cover it because it is very complicated. And it does take some familiarity with issues that are not easily accessible. And I think that that's a real shame. I know that all of the big advocacy organizations, certainly the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, have been speaking publicly about it. But the fact of the matter is that's not enough. It has to be an echo chamber that includes the tens, I'd even say hundreds of millions of Americans, we the people of the United States, who have an interest in guarding and restoring our own rights.
There's been some victories recently. You mentioned in Northampton, and maybe I guess there were some other ones that you didn't mention by name. So what happened in Northampton?
Northampton, Massachusetts, just this very week, passed a local resolution to restore due process. And it says that the local public agencies will be encouraged not to participate or support any federal applications of these powers. It also says that that vote to dissent by the city in its formal official capacity will be sent up the chain to the congressional representatives who represent that district. The first of the resolutions rejecting the NDAA came from a county in Colorado that encompasses the Air Force Academy. And it's red, white, and blue patriotism straight through and through. It says that these are not the principles that our armed services fought and died to defend. And you see in the grassroots resistance to indefinite military detention a very compelling confluence among what some might describe as unholy bedfellows, the libertarian right and progressive sectors of our society, people of color, peace and justice activists, the Occupy movements, and the Tea Party chapters, and the Campaign for Liberty, and the 10th Amendment Center coming together around this set of principles that are so fundamental, so deeply ingrained and enmeshed that they constitute what America has long been known for. The presumption of innocence is not a small matter. That was world historical when we introduced it to the world, and we've resigned it with such casual indifference that I think the opportunity to bring these very diverse voices together is quite frankly inspiring. And while the NDAA itself might represent a constitutional atrocity, it also represents the opportunity, I think, for our country to remember in this time of very deep partisan vitriol what makes us all Americans.
That was Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Find links to additional information about the campaign to overturn the indefinite detention law on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Consumer groups Food and Water Watch, Consumers Union, and the Center for Food Safety filed a petition in early February seeking action from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, to classify and evaluate a Massachusetts-based company's genetically engineered salmon food product. The company, Aqua Bounty Technologies, has inserted Atlantic salmon with a growth gene from a Chinook salmon and an antifreeze gene from an ocean pout, an eel-like fish. The so-called Aqua Advantage salmon grows twice as fast as typical native salmon species and consumes about 10% less food. The group's petition asked the FDA to test the genetically engineered salmon as a food additive, not as a new animal drug, which requires a less rigorous review. Environmental groups are also urging the FDA to conduct an environmental study, citing concerns that GE salmon could escape and carry disease to and or breed with native salmon species. One major concern cited by the petitioning groups is Aqua Bounty's own study that found that their GE salmon may contain increased levels of IGF-1, a hormone that accelerates growth in the fish and is linked to breast, colon, prostate, and lung cancers in humans. Your reporter spoke with Patty Lovera, deputy director with Food and Water Watch. She explains why her group is demanding greater government scrutiny of genetically engineered salmon and the hazards the new food product could pose to human health.
There's a proposal that the FDA is considering. They've had it for a while now, and Aqua Bounty is the company that wants to make this genetically engineered salmon. And this is, it's, you know, notable for a lot of reasons, but also because this would be the first genetically engineered animal that's meant for our diets. There was a previous There have been some previous approvals of genetically engineered animals, but this would be the first one that is intended to be human food. And what they did to the salmon was they put genes from other types of fish. They put a gene from a different species of salmon and from a fish, or actually an eel-like creature called a pout, and they put those genes into an Atlantic salmon supposedly to make it grow faster. So it's supposed to get to market size in half the time. But we're real concerned that the FDA is not doing a very thorough job in looking at this and thinking about all the different things that could have changed in addition to that growth rate. So, you know, we're real concerned about what happens if they get out into the environment and impact wild fish. We don't think FDA has done enough looking into what else might change about the nutrition or the risk of allergies or things like that. So we've been calling on FDA to do a different process than the one they're doing now, because they're actually evaluating this like it's a drug, not like it's a food. So we actually just filed a petition a week or so ago saying you should evaluate this like it's a food, because that's how it's going to end up.
What are the potential dangers for people who might eat these genetically modified foods, specifically this new variety of salmon they've created?
Well, we don't really know, which is one of the problems. And so, you know, in this process that the FDA is using where they evaluate it like it's a new animal drug, the data comes from the company. So Aqua Bounty has submitted, you know, the data in their application to FDA. We don't get to see that data as the public. We get to see summaries of the data. So we have some summary documents, but we don't have the actual studies. But what we do know is that there's not that many studies and they're not that big. And so we've been saying that they need to do more of them. But one of the things we're worried about is that it's not just the growth rate that changed, that other things might be changing. So we're worried about, you know, is the nutrition the same? Is it the same levels of, you know, fatty acids and things like that, that you know what you get when you buy a normal non-engineered salmon? Are we going to get the same thing if you buy this salmon? And then one of the real specific questions people are asking about health impacts is that this salmon grows faster because it has elevated levels of a growth hormone. That's why it's going to grow faster, and it's going to grow steadily through the year and not take a break in the cold seasons. What do we know about eating a fish that has higher levels of that growth hormone? That's one of the questions we think the FDA should be looking at.
I've read that this growth hormone used there in that fish, IGF-1, is linked to several varieties of cancers found in humans. Tell us more about that.
So that's one of the areas of concern. So this has been an issue in some other foods when we treat dairy cows with artificial growth hormones to get them to produce more milk. There's been concerns about people being exposed to growth hormones through that route, and then we're worried that this could be an additional way that people could be exposed if they're eating this genetically engineered fish and it has higher levels of the growth hormones. And there have been some research to associate elevated levels of this IGF-1 and certain types of cancer like prostate cancer and breast cancer. And so that's one of the things we think they should be spending a lot more time on, doing a lot more analysis of that before you put this food out on the market. We need to make sure that that's not a risk that we're exposing people to.
What can you tell us about getting this stuff out to the public more? I would hazard a guess that most people in this country aren't aware that this genetically engineered salmon is in the pipeline. What kind of work is your group doing to get the word out about these issues and to have them respond directly to the government, to the Food and Drug Administration, and these other agencies that are in charge of passing these through onto the consumers?
Yeah, that's really what it all boils down to, because until we do more of that, and until elected officials and then folks in running these agencies know that the public wants something different, they have an excuse to just keep doing the same old thing. So we spend a lot of time and effort on that. We have a ton of stuff on our website, which is foodandwaterwatch.org. Lots of other groups are doing similar campaigns, whether it's on labeling of these foods or trying to stop new approvals of new genetically engineered crops. So people, should find a group like us or another group that's working on food issues and just stay tuned and look for ways to get involved. We're always sending out alerts about ways you can, contact your members of Congress or contact the agencies and really do things like that. And we're all experimenting with other ways to get the word out there. So we have a bunch of stuff on Facebook right now about, getting Walmart to say no to genetically engineered sweet corn and trying little cartoons and stuff like that just to try to catch people in a different way. And we're always looking for ideas for that, and we always need help spreading the word. So if people can forward stuff on and then, tell their friends and family about it, that's what we need to be doing.
That was Patty Lavera, Deputy Director with the group Food and Water Watch. Learn more about the issues of food safety and genetically engineered products on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.